It's Monday, August 5th, 2013, and you're listening to episode 306 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 56 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Wayne.
This is Beth.
This is John.
And this is Chris.
So, John.
Yes?
You had an issue that I almost had, and both of us had this in our online Pathfinder games. Why don't you go ahead and set this up, and then I'll explain how it actually ended up working out for me.
Are we talking about inappropriate commentary?
No, I'm not going.
Which one are we talking about?
Can we have inappropriate
Runaway
commentary?
Success
can we talk about
Oh, right. That issue. Okay.
We have inappropriate commentary everywhere.
So sidestepping when your players get suddenly and awfully racist and you don't know how to react to it, there is also what happens when you suddenly find yourself kicking the crap out of your player characters with NPCs that were not designed to kick the crap out of them. What do you do? Case in point in gaming story. I had three player characters, I believe two were level 3, one was level 4, facing down a group of 10 or 12 hobgoblins, no class levels. They should have been able to annihilate them, but I decided I couldn't roll any lower than a 17 on a d20 or any lower than a 6 on a d8. And since I roll out in the open with no screen or anything like that, it was just like, well, okay, one's dead, two's dead, the third one got captured. See you guys next week. We'll have to think of a jailbreak game or something.
That's hilarious.
So,
that is awesome.
The question is, when you are on the craps run of your life as a GM and you pulverize your player characters without particularly wanting to, what do you do?
Yeah, because as a game master, I mean, generally speaking, what you want to accomplish in most combats is to challenge the party without defeating them.
Yes. Because, same golf rules. Make it look hard, make it play easy.
Right, because if you are not challenging them, then the encounter's boring. If you're beating the crap out of them, and this is not an intended dramatic device, you are just...
You're frustrating.
And if you
them.
Are yeah. beating the crap out of them, because this is the part where the PCs lose, go to hell.
I would agree with that, but that's something of a separate issue. But the point being that I think it's fair to say that for the majority of combats, you want something that is challenging, but ultimately the PCs win. This can go off the rails one of two opposite directions. Either the PCs get on a roll of their own, in which case the combat becomes a joke. Now, depending on how long that combat is, for example, if we're talking about BattleTech, where that combat could go on 2, 4, 6 hours, then that can get problematically boring. In most games, a combat where the PCs are doing really well, it's not going to take all that long to resolve anyway, and so a particular outing kind of fell on its ass, but no big deal, right? You know, you just...
And in most cases where the PCs short-circuit a combat encounter because of cleverness, they're perfectly okay with that. They don't say, well, that was too easy because we circumvented the challenge. They say, oh my god, I'm so smart, give me all the treasure.
All right.
Yeah, I'm much more likely to fall into the here's something I thought was going to be really challenging, and they've just utterly crushed it because you've seen how I roll dice.
Yeah, that's true.
Poor Wayne.
Things are supposed to be a challenge, but...
One day I will get you to the crap table, and I will bet on aces and trays, and I will make lots of money.
But, you know, even so, you have to say, even crappy hobgoblins have a good day sometimes.
Exactly.
So... I mean, this falls within the realm of possibility.
Right, and I ran them like intelligent enemies, but they were intelligent enemies who had 8 hit points and plus 2 on their attack roll. Like, they should not have been able to wipe the floor with a couple of level 3 and 4 characters.
It could have been the perfect storm. The hobgoblins were having a fantastic day, and your PCs were having a crap day.
They underestimated the power of the hobgoblins.
They had a good breakfast.
And they didn't have any area of effect.
Yes, they ate their Wheaties.
Which is something I should have calculated
in the
beginning.
They did eat their Wheaties,
like,
I'd say.
A CR 3 or 4 encounter that has a lot of individual fighters against Barbarian Fighter Ranger is a very hard CR 4 encounter because you're counting on that one dude with the fireball to end the thing before it begins, and he's not there. So part of it was my fault. It's like sending a shadow up against a group of characters that has no casters and no magic weapons. It's not that bad, but... You have to anticipate that you may be attacking the characters in a manner with which they're not prepared.
I've run the entire spectrum of that where, I kicked their ass with people who I shouldn't have kicked their ass with. Yep, they've kicked my ass when they shouldn't have been able to kick my ass. All spaces in between. And honestly, it depends on where it was at in the story and where it was at in the campaign. I completely derailed my own campaign when I, unleashed a TPK with save for two characters that we had to completely start over. After that, and they were just trying to get into town to continue on the adventure, and one of the players decided to play his character true to character, would not pay the tax, and carnage ensued, and then we were done for the night.
Okay, if your character died of stupid because there was a toll booth and he said screw the police, then I'm not that sympathetic.
I'm with John on this one. If you die because
that was my attitude at the time, though, because I thought to myself, okay, it's great that you're being true to your character, but right now you're being an ass, and so you're going to pay for it. And
no,
and he paid for it.
The older and nastier I get, the more I don't care if you're true to your own character. If you're being an idiot, the truth of your character then resolves itself in your character dying.
Yeah.
If your character is an idiot,
and that's exactly what happened to this guy.
There you go.
Go with God.
Then I would have done exactly what you did, Chris.
Right now, we are watching the result of Whitey Bulger being true to his character.
What I find in this kind of situation is I tend to adjust the hit points of the things they're fighting. I won't, once the combat started, adjust any of the other stats, because I know there's at least one person at the table that will kind of keep in his mind what he needs to hit. But other than that, I'll adjust the hit points because nobody knows what their hit points are but me.
I do that sometimes.
I don't like
mine
to do
that. Mine were so low already that they were basically one-hit kills to begin with, and they were still beating the crap out of the PCs.
But, it still works. I mean, yeah, you have to figure out a jailbreak, but jailbreaks can be fun. I mean,
yeah. Oh, no, the show rolled on. I just had to adapt a little bit.
Assuming they take prisoners. I mean, what if what you're dealing with here is a bunch of undead that aren't per se under the direct control of a...
necromancer?
Yeah, a necromancer who's interested in prisoners. You're just dealing with a bunch of random animalistic monsters.
Well, then they die. You're running campaigns over.
Yeah, you're running All Flesh Must Be Eaten in a zombie setting. They're going to eat you. What are you going to do?
I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all solution to this.
I do. Kill them.
Well, and that may be the answer, is depending on the group, maybe they've decided up front, look, we're okay with player death, we're okay with even party death. That's just how it rolls out. Maybe, depending on the system, you can say something like, well, they beat you into negative hit points, you're all in bad shape, but at that point, they lose interest and move on. And so you're not actually dead, but you're effectively dead. Maybe they do take prisoners. For example, in Battletech, this was a very real possibility because you guys were playing mercenaries back during the time when all of that kind of chivalry and those codes really mattered. And so when you guys walked into a combat and got your asses kicked, saying, we give, stop the battle, that was an option. And at that point, there are treaties that you can pull out of various source books that come into play that say, okay, you guys now have to quit the field and you have to observe certain terms and things like that. But surrender is an option. So if the bad guys are just getting ridiculously lucky, or you guys had a bad plan, like using your dropship as a forward fighting force, then
it has so many hit points, it'll never get killed. Also, we can ignore all light mechs because they can't do damage.
It's that one guy in the Locust.
Yeah. Okay.
See, this is why we should just play Dallas the role-playing game.
Hey, I would play the
ready
that.
For Dallas the role-playing
game. If a game session goes wrong, the next session you just start off with, you wake up.
It was all a dream.
Yes. Everyone starts with one Patrick Duffy wakes up card. And you can play it at any time. The session is over. Patrick Duffy wakes up. You start from the start.
Two other things I found that work is, first, depending on the game, what's going on, the party may not know everything about the enemies they're facing. And so it is possible you get away with rounding down their hit points a little bit, pulling their attacks a bit, changing the damage die they use. I don't know what you can get away with, but you might be able to kind of pull them back a little bit there. The second thing, and this is actually how I saved myself from this in the game that I'm running, was I had the party get attacked by these creatures of coalesced darkness. I was using the base template of a shadow, to John's point, but...
but depriving it of everything that makes a shadow even remotely dangerous.
Precisely. So they lost the...
You would have been fine adding the other two because it would have come to my turn and I would have cast sleep or used that color
spray. Well, but here's the thing, though.
It.
First turn out of the gate, those two things come out and their attack rolls are decent. I mean, they attack at like a plus four, but it ain't great. And so I thought, well, surely they're not going to do that much. And in the first round, they nearly killed two people. And I'm like, oh, hell, I've got a real problem. Because the way I had this planned out was two were going to appear immediately. A third one was going to appear on the next round. A fourth one was going to appear on the round after that. And so I'm thinking, oh, crap. By the time that I have that fourth one out, I'm going to have two people already dead. And the remaining people are really not going to be able to take these things down. Because while I stripped them of their really unique powers that would have made them truly dangerous, it's a bunch of first level characters. And these things still, in the course of a hit or two, can take somebody down. And they have sufficient hit points that it takes several hits to take the enemies down. And so in my case, I just hedged by not having three and four appear. I had never told the players three and four were going to appear. And so I just didn't have it happen. I stuck at one and two. At that point, it turned out to be kind of moot anyway, because they managed just to work one down the good old fashioned way. And the other one, John hit him with something. And it was, I think it was color spray or daze or something.
Yeah,
like that.
I had a color spray wand, which at level one is like a stick of go to hell, we win.
Yeah. And so
you, 19 charge battery life still remaining on it.
It hit him with this and he didn't make the save. Put him into a stun. We rolled that out and it came up with like four or five rounds where he's standing there with no dex bonus, no nothing, just standing there while they wail on him. And needless to say, that thing went down pretty quickly. So it turned out not to be an issue.
So one thing I always keep in my back pocket that I think would work really well in your games too, Dan, is other factions. Usually there are multiple factions going on in the story that aren't getting along with each other. You can have a third party show up and interfere. They're not saving your PCs, you know, unless they actually are allied with your PCs. It's just here is another variable to throw into the mix.
Right.
Now, instead of the bad guys focusing on you, they may have to turn and fight.
Sure. And those may be bad guys that you can negotiate with, or at least antagonists who aren't so bloodthirsty.
Or run while they're fighting.
Yeah, precisely. Maybe they create a distraction that lets you retreat from the field, or maybe even they don't do that, but you're fighting a bunch of just mindless monsters, but along comes the soldiers from the enemy kingdom. They kill the mindless monsters, and they're willing to take prisoners. If we talk about the classic role-playing game setup, usually you have in mind what happens if the party succeeds. If it's D&D or Pathfinder, you've got a treasure table. If it's any RPG, you've got the enemy's inventory. If it's something like Battletech, you're playing mercenaries, you've got what they get for contract fulfillment. Okay, we work through what it is you're going to get if the party succeeds.
Or you forgot to make the treasure table and you're like, do they all have a ring of protection plus one yet? No, they don't. There it is. Not that I do that.
I would recommend taking the same thing in reverse of when you're sketching out these combats. Think in the back of your mind, what happens if the party starts to fall apart? It's not something that I typically do, and it feels like a bit of added work, but I think it's useful added work to know in advance what you're going to do if this goes pear-shaped.
Dan, I think one of the things, going back to your first point real briefly, I think there is an inherent fear, though, in most party groups to actually engage and surrender when they realize that they may lose this and they can't get away. You know, I think it does vary from game to game, depending upon what, you know, setting and genre you're in, but it is not something that most players are, you know, open to engaging in. They have that fear that something horrible is going to happen to them, and they don't
because they know what they do to those who surrender. Well, to them.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we talked at length about that on another episode.
Well, and you're trained to think there's no way out. But
right,
forward.
Right. And we've said this on prior episodes too. And the RPG hero myth fantasy story is an inversion of the literary hero myth fantasy story, because it's not a series of successive defeats that leads to a victory. It's a series of successive victories that lead to more other successive victories.
Because isn't life like that?
There's no defeat in the script of a tabletop RPG, even temporary.
Yeah, in other media, the hero is constantly beaten up until he gets to that victory.
No.
And usually by the time that victory is there, he's pretty banged up and barely walking.
Yeah.
It's not a steady progression.
Dramatic
of
tension is maintained by crap going wrong the whole time.
Yeah.
Whereas dramatic tension in RPG is maintained by, oh my God, what am I going to roll for my attack roll?
Here's the thing, too. I mean, you have to have an escape hatch, and if you don't, you have to be willing to retcon it. Because if you...
No.
No.
Do you retcon, Beth?
I don't run crap, so...
You've run at least one game.
So the answer is no.
But would you? Would you be satisfied that as a PC?
It would depend on the situation.
Okay.
I mean, most of the time I want to just roll with it.
What are the factors that make it depend?
If it was just an out-and-out slaughter, and it was just ridiculous, like the Monty Python foot came down and just went... And it's like, okay, no, that could not have happened. Or if there was some sort of significant mistake that was made on either side, like... Oh my God, we forgot we had this atom bomb in the...
Oh, yeah, no, if there was a bookkeeping mistake, yeah, I'm totally about rewinding the clock, yeah, but I'm talking...
fighting fire elementals and we all have a cloak of fire immunity.
Yeah. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the dice ran hard against us, so we're just putting it back in the bag.
For the most part...
That disgusts me.
No, for the most part, I want to roll with it because I want to roll with it.
Yeah, you have to maintain the threat.
Yeah.
It's not a victory if you realize that... Oh, I'm just going to win even if I lose.
Yeah, it's not a victory unless there's some sort of hardship. I agree with you.
Or the possibility of not being victorious,
however illusory. But if you get to the point where, like, you've all agreed there's going to be no player death, we're running this kind of campaign.
I've already left this gaming group.
Shut up, John. Well, I'm talking hypothetically.
Chris, all right. Talking to your point about the party not being willing to surrender, I have two comments. First off, I think in some situations... That's not an issue just by the reality of what's going on. There's nothing left to fight with. Their ass has been beaten. Let's use a Battletech example. The mechs are destroyed. Maybe the pilots aren't dead. Maybe Wayne is because a Thunderbolt kicked him. But nonetheless, you know, the mechs are destroyed. Not surrendering is not per se an option. Let's use a D&D or a Pathfinder example. The party's either low hit points, zero hit points, or negative hit points. Not surrendering is really not possible because surrendering may not be possible. You are without action. But the other thing that I would say is I think the game master really kind of has to be prepared, if this is the kind of game that he or she is wanting to run, to sort of train the party. And some of this may come through just outright declaration, but also through certainly demonstrating in the game that failure doesn't have to be the end of the road. I mean, John, you said something that I think can't be emphasized enough. If you look at the vast majority of storytelling traditions, think about movies you've seen lately, books you've read, the story, as you noted, there might be some successes in there, but the dramatic tension is built by a lot of failures.
No.
You fail and fail and fail and fail and fail. And then finally, at the end of the story, Batman catches the Joker. And that's how it ends. Look, I've read books, I've seen movies where all a person does is succeed and succeed and succeed and succeed. And you know what they are? It's Mary Sue and Marty Stew stories that are boring and obnoxious.
Yeah, and I've seen the other side of that where the main character is just constantly beat up and never gets success and always wins by some sort of caveat.
That's also cheap.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't have your main character be completely beat to and then all of a sudden, oh, well, I'm going to let you win on a technicality, but you can't always have them be successful either. It's a very, very fine line. And I would say the same thing about GMing. You have to give the players enough taste of success to make them keep wanting more, but you can't make it easy.
Right.
Even if they win, but they limp away off the battlefield, that in and of itself can be a defeat of sorts that, jeez, we got to watch that next time, or we need to be better prepared next time. But it's still... is in a lot of ways, you know, considered a defeat.
Another possibility that I think you can throw out there, once again, this is not a good idea for every situation, but this is an option that you can fall back on, is give the player some kind of a disposable power. Let me give you an example. This is one that I actually used in a D&D game. I had a guy who's playing a Monk of Illimiter, and I gave him a magical item where he could basically drop himself to, it was like either zero or negative one hit points. He would destroy himself. But in the process, he could make other party members temporarily immune to damage. Now, this was not something he could use frequently. This did a lot of damage to him to use it, but it was at least in there. You can have something like, okay, you saved the giant eagles from bad things, whatever. And so they give you a little horn, and if you blow it once, just once, they will come and save you.
The edge.
Yeah, exactly. This is not something they can use all the time, but the party has this emergency escape hatch, and this is something that they can use if a combat is going completely out of control. They're just getting clowned, and nobody at the table expected this to happen. Once again, is this right for all stories, all circumstances? No, absolutely not. But it is an option.
This reminds me, again, warning, gaming story. There was a battle we all fought, and it was huge, and it was bad, and it was on a cave ledge, and this was the damn Wand of Wonder.
Hey, the bag of beans has one purpose.
To screw you?
No, it has two purposes, and that's to screw you. I don't remember.
There is nothing damnable about a Wand of Wonder. It is wonderful.
No, it is not. It's horrible. The last monster is up by like 2 hit points. So he hits it. He hits resurrect everything. So all the monsters come back up. But we're all half dead. We're actually all lots dead. So we had to deal with it. I mean, we had to keep going.
Well, I don't think the Wand of Wonder is your escape hatch because the fact that you can't believe what the hell's going to do.
Because sometimes it's
also
a trap. The
Wand of Wonder is evil. The Wand of Wonder is bad. That is my advice to everyone out there. This bad. Like,
you know, I know how I'm going to sort out the problems in my game. Deck of many things.
Yeah.
If I had a Wand of Wonder, I know I would never give it to Pat.
He wouldn't take it.
He'd never use it. It just sat there.
No, he's a hoarder.
I wouldn't use it.
I wouldn't touch the thing.
All right. Host poll. Deck of many things. You see the deck. The voice asks, how many cards? What is the answer? For me, it is none.
Yeah, the answer
zero.
Is go to hell.
Keeping that as a caveat, I've never seen it in game, never seen it played. I would have to see it used at least once. So I would say 3.
Oh my God.
3, you would die.
I've done it actually twice. One time I took 4, and then one time I took 2.
The caveat would be that you would need to take 3 1,000 miles from me.
If I was just really mentally impaired, I'm talking like I was either drunk or suffering from a concussion or tripping on mushrooms. I don't know what the situation would be. I might take 1 just because. That's as far as I would go.
See, because I've never seen it, I have to see it get used if it comes up. I would definitely take cards.
Wayne, this is why you should never own a gun.
Wayne, if you had never seen
a rusty
fish hook, would you have to claw yourself with it just because it had never been done?
Have you ever tasted Drano?
Do you want to?
There's a difference between seeing something in game and in real life.
Do you walk around your house thinking, I've never put this in my ass before?
I wonder what that would be like.
There's a many difference between times. Game and real life. If I was playing Fatal, maybe I would think that.
Yeah, here's the difference, Wayne. When you do it in real life, you only hurt yourself. When you do it in a game, you screw up the experience for everybody.
I would only
because when you summon some lesser death or who knows what, you know, I can't remember the rules.
Lesser death will stop once it has killed the person.
That's what I thought.
But if you attack the lesser death, it spawns another one for you.
Somebody in the party is going to feel guilty or not know that rule and is going to get themselves involved, and it's all downhill
you
from
pull
there.
That thing, I wouldn't I'm know out.
That. I wouldn't know that because I have no idea what's in the deck.
We had a guy.
No idea of a single item in the deck until now. I know that there's a. You know, whatever that you guys have just mentioned.
Yeah.
So it's I would attack and help.
The equivalent of saying, I have a hotel, and in this hotel is X number of rooms.
Each one of those rooms are themed.
Yeah, precisely. And one half of them contain things like winning lottery tickets, beautiful women, wonderful feasts. The other half contains things like a prison shower, Bengal tigers. Barbed wire you have to run through.
Rusty fishhooks in your eye.
How many keys would you like to the doors of this hotel?
0.
Then the only answer to this, as far as I'm concerned, is
we
0.
I was in a campaign once where basically every Christmas, if we were playing around Christmas time in the campaign, he would do a divergent side trek adventure where he had this character, and he always termed him as Satan Claus, and he would come down and he would appear before the characters, and he would take out the deck of many things for all the PCs and allow them to draw if they wanted to draw, and whatever happened he implemented then into the campaign moving forward. And we actually had some interesting plot hooks come, although we did have one guy who drew the soul card that, you know, trapped his soul in the other dimension. That wasn't very much fun for him, but it was good times.
Like,
that's the Bengal tiger room.
Merry Christmas. I'm taking
that's
your
right.
soul.
Goodbye, soul.
The only story that I can think of even vaguely like this was in a D&D game years ago. Okay, this is one of those like crazy you're playing role-playing games for your first couple years and being an idiot kind of things. And I wasn't directly involved in this, but there was another guy who was a player, and he got a hold of an alter self spell or something to that effect and made himself look like Santa Claus. And it was basically just breaking into houses, telling the kids to go back to bed, and then robbing the place.
I can't believe I didn't think of that.
We had a guy in Deadlands who had like the Dead Ringer hindrance, and so he said he looked like Wyatt Earp, and so he went and pissed off a bunch of people, and so they sent them and told him he was Wyatt Earp, and sent them after the real Wyatt Earp, just to be an asshole. It was great.
Nice.
That was how Gaz got killed in the first Blood Moon Goblins campaign. Someone did alter self and pretended to be him and attacked the orc tribe, and then the orc tribe killed him.
Characters are really jerks.
Yeah, well, you know, that happens.
That's why they're unemployed.
Yes, that's why they're...
They are unemployed.
This is my theory. If there wasn't something wrong with you, you wouldn't be out adventuring. You'd be at home with a job and a family.
I did enjoy that part of the Torchbearer blurb. It's like, this world is awful, and you have no place in it, which is why you wander around ruins looking for dropped coins. You do not occupy a cherished place in society, and your life is not happy.
You can't hold a job, so now you're wandering around grave robbing.
Yes.
What was this from?
Luke Crane kickstarted a traditional kind of OSR dungeon crawler game called Torchbearer. The blurb just had a little bit of world building, but it was basically like all the wealth and the means in the world are concentrated in the hands of a tiny sliver of the top of the pyramid who own everything. You know, if you are their chosen heir, you're okay. But if you're not, your choices are join the army, be a dirt farmer who half starves to death, do nothing and totally starve to death, or join the clergy. But so many people have already tried to do that, that all they do is give you a holy symbol and send you back out to the door to be a missionary. So you go with option C.
Grave robbing.
Be a quote unquote adventurer in which you take your meager possessions around and look for crap that fell on the floor.
So it's basically like dumpster diving in a world where skeletons are real.
Exactly. You're not a noble hero of yore when you are a D&D adventurer. You are a dumpster diver and a grave robber.
Something's wrong with you.
Yes.
Or something's wrong with the world.
You don't have maybe any other opportunities. Yes.
All right. So the other thing we want to talk about this episode is campaign length.
8 inches.
8 inches. That's cheap.
You do it in short story arcs like Wayne does.
So you named it campaign.
So you named it story
left
arc.
Dungeon and right master.
So here's the thing. Obviously, there are many different lengths that a campaign can run. A campaign could run a single sitting or a very small number of sittings. You sit down, you play the game. It's a one shot that might stretch over two or three sittings, which I guess technically doesn't make it a one shot anymore, but it's more or less the same as a one shot. You have a short plot. There's a setup, one plot point, you know, that really is kind of the crux of the whole thing. That gets resolved. It's all over. The second option is you go with something that's more chapter based, where you set up a game where you're intending for this to run. If we presuppose a weekly game, this chapter is going to run, let's say, somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 6 months. And at the end of that, there is an intended point where all this comes to a satisfactory close. Maybe the whole thing's not over, but at least what you set out to do is resolved. And if people want to keep going, there's hooks to keep going with this. The third option is to tell a much more epic style campaign where there is a very large, very complicated plot that will take a long time to achieve and does not necessarily have really clean chapter breaks along the way. Or even if it does, it might have stopping points where you can kind of put the game down for a while and then come back to it. But the central plot is not resolved at the end of a chapter. It's not per se like each chapter had a major plot that got resolved. The major plot goes on from chapter to chapter to chapter. What you're solving in each chapter is going to be some sub-portion of that singular plot. We've laid out these options in past episodes, and so I don't think we need to rehash that. But the discussion that came up recently is which of these really, in some ways, is even possible. And John, I'm going to have you kick this off again, not just because, you know, it's nice to have you here, which isn't, you know, something that happens as frequently anymore. But this really came up because of the fact that Wayne converted you.
Wayne did convert me.
Oh, my gosh.
I am now an arc-based gamer for Rizzle, because I don't think that super long, super involved campaigns are politically possible in a group of people that are no longer in high school or college. I think you've got to have arcing chapters that start and end that have something that they're working toward to keep everyone moving toward a dramatic goal and to allow for that conclusion and that release, or else you are inevitably going to get a frayed slurry of campaign elements that runs together and runs together and then dies because Bob moved away, or Sally decided that, well, this wasn't really the kind of campaign that she wanted to run in the first place, or the whole group just blows up, or someone has a kid, or whatever.
Now, there's also another point that you threw out when we were setting this up within our forum discussions, where you said, is a short campaign really a short story at all, given that it's probably going to go 50 plus hours?
That is a secondary point.
You know, I had not really looked at it that way before, and I'm actually going to come down the other side of this, but I want to set up the point here before we open up the debate.
I was floored by that math when I read it. I had never really thought about it. I sat there and I started going
really
through.
Really long. Yeah. A short campaign is like 10 movies long.
Yeah. You think about it in terms of a movie, even what as of right now is a relatively long movie is going to be 2 to 3 hours. If you think
less than one sitting,
if you think about that in terms of a video game, if you're playing something that's more like an FPS or an adventure game, you're probably talking 10 to 20 hours. If you have an RPG, particularly not a sandbox one, but let's say something that's more of a story driven RPG, you're looking at maybe 40 to 60 hours. You are only going to break that threshold if you get into one of these sandbox games, and on top of that, you are a really obsessive player. Yeah,
get all of the secret tags or
yeah,
bongs
precisely.
Or whatever the hell
you are somebody
got.
That
bongs?
Will not.
San Andreas.
You are somebody that will not stop playing Elder Scrolls until you have done everything there is to do in the world.
Right.
It's a Mexican soap opera. That's exactly what it is. You guys run Mexican soap operas because yes, it's a telenovela because telenovelas have an established beginning point, an established end point, and they last about 6 months.
Right. And old Mexican ladies are crazy into telenovelas. Why? Because there is tension and a finite amount of character space.
And lots of fireworks.
They don't turn the episode in and on, and they're like, oh, this is episode 472. It's basically going to end at the same point that it started at, and the wacky adventures will go on. They think, like, holy crap, we're on the doorstep of El Diablo, and, going to kill him.
Well, I look at it more like comic books versus manga. American comic books, if it is a mainstream character, like, say, a Batman or a Superman, after everything's done, you're going to end up back at basically the same place, and you're going to have the story that continues on forever, but there are mini arcs on it. When you look over at, say, Japanese manga, you're more likely to have, here is the complete story in one arc.
Yes.
And both are good for different things. I love both of them. Same thing with gaming. I love the long 2-year arc. I like the idea of it. I've just never seen it work.
Well, let me straighten out the metaphor here a little bit before I try and defend the longer arcs.
Yes, me too.
Which is, I think there is a difference between a long campaign and an indeterminate campaign. Because I can set out to run a game that I know, even if we stick with it and don't get distracted by the new shiny and Bob doesn't move away and Sally doesn't decide this is the kind of campaign she never really wanted in the first place, all these other things. Let's just assume a perfect world that it may take 2 or 3 years to work through.
So we've already diverged hopelessly from reality and this is just a thought exercise.
No, and I will defend why not here in a moment. Okay. But the point being that there is still an end. There is still a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's just going to take a lot longer to get there. That's very different than an American soap opera or a generic comic book where the story is meant to go on indeterminately. Let's look at a sitcom. They have to wrap up all their problems and reset their world in the course of 30 minutes because otherwise they have just made the possibility of future episodes a whole lot more difficult. And so they have to keep meandering somewhere in the middle. Now, maybe that's a viable method of gaming. I'm not going to say one or the other because I've never played in that kind of game. Every game I've played in, the game master had some ending in mind. Whether we got there or not, some ending was at least in the theory. And so maybe an indeterminate game works. I don't know. But I just do want to straighten out that the metaphor we're talking about doesn't quite work all the way because what I am prepared to defend is a long campaign, not an indeterminate campaign.
So when I hear the kind of games that Beth and Pat used to play, it's exactly what we're saying there, where it seems like there were story arcs going, but it's one game that never ends with no end in mind.
If you guys run telenovelas, we were running As the World Turns. We all played the same characters, and they kept leveling up, and different things were going on within the world. We never really called them arcs, but there would be certain things that were going on, and then we would investigate them and get finished with them, and then something else would happen. Or maybe the consequences of what we did over here affected something over in Area B or something.
Yeah, and when I hear you guys talk about that, I don't see that as one big long campaign. I see that as a bunch of campaigns. You know, one campaign happened, that was the story, the next big thing happens, that's the next campaign. That's how I would have looked at it.
See, I guess I just never put that together, but I liked it because I had a character I liked, I was able to keep that character I like, and continue to grow with her and like level up and do different things and take that to completion. When I came up here and you guys started playing, it was a lot of, okay, well, we're going to run this for like 5 episodes, and then I would get a character I like, and it's like, okay, we're going to put this down and go make a new character. But I like that one. Well, too bad. We're going moving on to something else. But I like that one. Nope, too bad.
I hear that from my own PCs when I run arc-based things, because when I get to the end of the arc, I want to put it down and play something. And a lot of the times it's, but I want to keep playing. And I'm just sort of like,
too bad.
No, it's time for me to play. You wrote something.
That is exactly one of the reasons why I tend to do arcs, is because I want to play too.
Yep.
I don't want to always GM. To do the type of campaign that you're describing, Dan, you have to have a GM that wants to run for 2 years, 3 years.
And to be fair,
I want breaks.
To be fair, that was an issue that we faced with our campaigns, at least with one of them. We had one GM that was perfectly happy just GMing the entire time. And then we had one GM that would want breaks to try and play himself and then to go back to the main campaign. But the breaks never really worked. And I'm not really sure why. Probably because everyone else in the group wasn't really as adept at GMing as he was. So those kind of attempts to sort of break that up never really came to fruition.
I don't know if I could ever do the arc style that you guys talk about, simply because of the fact that I do enjoy GMing all the time. And even though now that we're done and now I'm going to be able to be a player for a while, I already have the itch to actually sit back in the chair, even though I know I should not. I need to sit and play for a little while and not run something. But I don't think I could adapt well to that arc idea, simply because I like to have an end for those particular characters and then move on to something somewhere else, someplace else, some genre else, and make up new characters and start over again. Because I want a nice, successful end to that series. I want my series to last its, 3 years or whatever it is, whatever TV analogy you want to attach onto that, and then be done, and then you go and you watch a different show, and then move on from there. I understand the arc idea and concept, but when I have a good, successful conclusion, what I feel is a successful conclusion for those characters, I want them to be done. And if we want to come back and do something with them, then that's fine later on.
But what if I still like that character? And what if I still want to keep going? I mean, unless that character dies, there's still stuff going on. Like, for example,
there's always going to be stuff going on. You have to, at some point, there's never been any character where, unless they die, like you say, that you're ever going to be truly, fully satisfied with this end. Because you're always going to think, well, there's this that can happen here, and there's this and that can happen there.
Anything that ends on a powerful, strong, good note is going to leave you with that feeling of, oh, I want more. Yeah. And that's just part of the game. That's just a sign that you did it right.
So one of the big reasons I like to do arcs is because I've never got the completion from a long campaign. I have never seen a long campaign reach the end of its story. Every one of them I really got into, and at the when the game fell apart, I was left really disappointed, wondering how the story would have ended. And I don't want that. I want the completion of the story. So when I do arcs, the end of an arc, that could be the end of that campaign. It hasn't wrapped up the overarching plot that the characters may not even know is going on, but it's an ending. And I feel there's completion there, and I'm not left being disappointed.
Wayne, I totally feel where you're coming from. One of the things that I've been working through over the past couple years of my own life, I mean, it's really no secret that this podcast is at least on some level kind of confessional in nature, because we go out, we game, we come back, and then we talk about what it is that we're going through. And for anyone who's been following this podcast, one of the things that we have repeatedly struggled with is sticking with something. I mean, this podcast is one of the few things we have successfully stuck with for a long period of time. I mean, we are notoriously bad at jumping at the new shiny, getting burnt out for the most silly of reasons and moving on. And so, Wayne, I completely understand your frustration that you have not seen one of these campaigns in, and it would be better to have an early ending than no ending at all. I completely get that. John, to your point, I also completely concede there is no way I could look you in the face with any amount of sincerity and tell you your points are not at least in principle accurate. The likelihood of a campaign being brought to fruition by a group of people that are as skittish and temperamental, to be blunt, as we are with our gaming, number one. And number two, who are caught up in all of the ups and downs and all of the obligations and whatnot of adult life,
right,
which could include things like moving to other cities.
Right, right, right.
Serious changes.
I never even brought that forward point up, which is true. But even if your group is not so distractible by the new shiny, and most people are, most right. groups are, we've had kids get born in the duration of this group. We've had people move back home and then move back away again. We've had people come in and out for matters of preference.
We've had
stuff. Yeah, this
people
is all
change
happened.
Jobs, and then the job change impacts their life in yeah. one way or another. Or maybe even they're at the same job, but just something changes at the job. And there are all kinds of
right.
things.
Everything is buttoned up when you're 16 and playing in study hall. Things are not buttoned up when you're in your 20s and 30s and 40s and crap is flying everywhere.
Right. That's a very fair point. But as to distracted by the new shiny, I have to admit, we never really had that. I had never really experienced that until I came up here. Maybe that was just a function.
Well, you were in a one GM group with characters that you wanted to play forever and ever. Amen.
That's true.
You had a lot of things going on to solidify the status quo forever.
Well, and for an understanding, both GMs played the same type of game, too. Weren't they both D&D
GMs? And you always played a conventional D&D or D&D-esque fantasy game.
Sort of.
All right, but let me now put this out here. I will fully admit that over my career of gaming, both as a player and as a GM, the majority of campaigns that I have been a part of have been designed with the intention of a long-running game. Once again, years, but not indeterminate. There was an ending out there somewhere, but it was a very, very ambitious sort of story. The majority of them, I will openly admit, even when I was a teenager, did not make it through to the end.
Yeah.
For one reason or another, whether it's interpersonal drama, changes in the life, new shiny, some kind of discouragement regarding the current game, whatever the case was, the majority of them fell apart. But off the top of my head, I can think of about half a dozen campaigns. Which may not sound like a lot, but let me reiterate, these are campaigns that ran 2-3 years, okay? So half a dozen of these, this is talking about at least intermittently large portions of my career as a gamer that didn't make it from their beginning all the way to the end. And it was not just random filler in the middle. It was not soap opera type stories. There was a huge story arc that was unfolding from the beginning all the way to the end. And the thing that I would say is, first off, while I acknowledge that the likelihood of success is low, the types of stories that I am most passionate about telling and most passionate about hearing are those that are ambitious. As a little bit of an allegory here, I used to work for a home building company. It's now out of business, which is not relevant to the story, but whatever, bit of trivia.
Nice touch, though.
Actually, in a way, it undermines my own story, but it is true. But while I was there, they had a guy that they had contracted to bring in to teach all kinds of stuff about quality management and goal setting and whatever, okay? And some of it was pop psych crap. Some of it was actually pretty interesting. I've talked about before where I've actually been trained in, like, the Dr. Duran industrial methods. This is where I picked all that up. It's from this guy. The owners of the company decided that they were going to set a goal for 100% customer satisfaction. And this consultant said, I don't think that's a good idea, because it's not realistic. There is no such thing as 100% customer satisfaction. It does not happen. And as a result, I'm afraid you're just going to be continuously discouraging your employees by giving them a goal that nobody can reach. But what their response was, and I think it's profound, at least in its intent, is they said, but that's the point of a goal. The point of a goal is to reach for something, and maybe you'll get it, maybe you won't. You probably won't. But it's the very act of reaching for that that keeps inspiring you to try new things, push yourself a little harder, to keep going for bigger and bigger things. So the first thing I'd say is the stories that I want to tell and the stories that I enjoy most being a part of are those that are set up to be a long journey. Now, even if it's a 100-mile journey and I only make it 10 miles down the 100 miles, that's still, to me, an enjoyable 10 miles. The other thing that I would say is, Wayne, I completely get your frustration, but I have seen these campaigns, even in my adult life, make it to their end.
I just finished one.
And those ends, because of the fact that they come on the tail of so much story, so much character investment, so many plot arcs and little side quests along the way, holy crap, is it an ending. I mean, when you put it down, you get the sense that you have just seen through not a chapter, but an epic. You have just seen something huge through to its end. And to me, that payoff is worth the 95% of them that will fail to get to the handful that succeed.
It's in a lot of ways, it's almost like winning the Super Bowl in a certain way, because it is such a feeling of satisfaction. And Dan, my experience kind of mirrors yours that you described there as well. I've been probably in about a handful, you know, of multi-year campaigns that have actually completed, you know, and I just completed one, you know, on my own with my current group. And yeah, that feeling of satisfaction you talk about at the end is exactly that. When I spoke the final words that would actually close that book out, it was kind of neat because it was just silent as everyone just kind of soaked in what had happened and took their own personal experiences away from that. And then we all just kind of, you know, ended up like looking at each other. And one of the guys finally said, you know what, that was really, really fun. And then we just kind of started recapping everything and talking about the parts that we enjoyed and the things that really stood out. And it was very book clubbish in a certain way after the fact when you kind of recap everything. It was very satisfying.
One of the most successful campaigns that I ran was one that ran 18 to 24 months. It was a Transformers campaign. And I took these guys from start to finish, this huge epic storyline. And when you're game mastering, you can't per se own the plot too much because you can't control it, or you shouldn't be controlling it, I guess I should say. You shouldn't be railroading people. But look, if you're a game master, in all probability, there are these scenes, there are these moments that you're envisioning. You're like, man, I can't wait until they do this. You're kind of picturing how it's going to go down. And one of the things that I found myself thinking about as we got closer and closer to that campaign was exactly how I wanted to portray the fall of the big bad, what I wanted that to look like. And we made it all the way to the end of that campaign with all of its ups and downs and all the intricacies of the story. And they finally unraveled all the mysteries. They got all the answers. They got to the what turned out in that case to be the final bad guy. They beat him. I got to narrate out the ending that I had in mind. We did the epilogue. And at the end of it, the players started clapping. And I'm serious about this. The players started clapping. And after that, man, we sat around and we talked about that game for hours. And then the next several times we got together, we talked about that campaign some more, just going over. It's like when you walk out of a movie and you're talking about, what'd you think of that movie? Same kind of thing of re-going over that and reliving those experiences. Like, man, it was so badass when this happened. And I really never saw that happening. And, you know, them asking me questions. So, Dan, what would have happened if we had done this instead of that? And it was just such an amazing feeling. And, you know, I can't sit here and just pontificate that, well, you ought to play this style of game. Because, look, I totally get what you guys are saying, that it'd be better to have a small story finished than large stories eternally stopped three chapters in. I absolutely get that. But I suppose my only point in all this is to explain why it is not cognitive dissonance for me to keep chasing what I'm chasing, because I know damn well the number of failures I'm likely to see along the way. And I incorporate that into my thinking and I accept that as part of what's going on. But I know at the same time that the successes when they occur are absolutely worth all the failures along the way.
So with an arc or a shorter campaign, though, you get some of that sense of completion at the end. You get some of that conversation. It's a matter of, because me personally, I like a lot of variety in my gaming as well. So I kind of look at it, if I've got 2 years to devote to gaming, would I rather have the one epic story, or do I want four really good stories? And I think personally, I would take the four really good over the one epic. That's purely a gaming history and personal choice.
Well, can't you have both? I mean, maybe this is naive, but you've got your epic story and you've got stepping stones along the way. So you've got your ultimate end, which is the major big bad going down, but you've got...
You have the lower level bosses along the way.
Exactly. So well, your first arc is getting rid of the first boss, but you know you haven't succeeded to getting the entire thing done, but you have a taste of success.
Yeah, well, and where I look at story arcs is books in a series. So the whole story is the series. The arc is an individual book. So when you look at books in a big series, for at least a series I've read, the issue that has come up in that story would be that book. That issue is completed, but there are bigger things going on. When you get to the end of a 10, 12, 20 series book, that was one big epic story made up by a bunch of really good stories along the way.
Right. Well, and Wayne, correct me if I'm wrong here, but part of how I understood what you were saying, at least from my knowledge of you as a person, is some of that variety you're looking for as well is not just in the stories, but also in the games.
Yeah, perfect. So, and that's why...
If you've got 2 years, you might want to do 6 months of Battletech, 6 months of Pathfinder, 6 months of Dresden, 6 months of Skies of Glass. Maybe one of those you're game mastering, three of them you're playing. You know, Beth, to your point, yes, you can absolutely have a campaign that has both elements of arc and chapter to it, but that's not necessarily going to give away in the type of variety.
In my case, I want a lot of variety, too. You know, let's say we're looking at a 2 year period and we're doing 6 month story arcs. Maybe you get two that are part of the same story and two that aren't. So two would be story arcs. The other would just be short campaigns of something else entirely different.
See, that's where you and I differ. Once I find something I like, I want to keep doing it and I want to do it every day. So just come to my house and run the same, not the same game, but like the same world, same characters.
What a
just
character.
Keep doing it.
What a player character.
Just keep doing it.
Keep entertaining me,
just
GM.
Go, go, go. Dance for me. Dance for me. Mm-hmm. That is your job, is to entertain me.
And you know, I think that works really well for groups that have the one person and only one that wants to GM. Yep. But for groups that have multiple GMs that want to trade in and out, and people like, I know John enjoys playing as well.
Yep.
I want to split that time about half and half. I'd like to play about as much as I run because I really enjoy both. I get something different out of each.
Absolutely. And that's part of what I like about ARCs too. I want to play and I want to run.
No. Dance, monkeys, dance.
I don't want to do either for years and years at a time.
I think we'll wrap this one up there. I've got some other things I want to talk about in terms of campaign length and ending stories and such, but I want to hold on to that for the next episode. We can give it really more attention. But before we close out, I do real quick want to mention something, which is in case you've not been keeping up with us on social media or the forums or whatever, Chris right now is running a Kickstarter for a project that he's working on. It's a video series he's hoping to launch called Table Tales. Chris, you want to kind of give us a real quick synopsis of the idea?
I certainly can. It's kind of ironic that we actually kind of mentioned aspects of almost everything that kind of occurs within the series itself. If you want to summarize into one sentence, the series is really the true stories of a group of tabletop gamers. Every episode in this series involves a storyline, a plotline that actually happened as an actual gaming story. And it's kind of, in a lot of ways, like with dramatic television, ripped from the gaming headlines, I guess, in this certain case, based on a true story. None of the names have been changed to protect the innocent or the guilty, depending upon which way you want to look at it. It's a live-action web series, and as I said, it's about actual, real, true-to-life gaming stories, and it allows you then, in certain ways, to actually tolerate hearing other people's gaming stories that kind
of... Impossible.
Exactly. That's what I first thought, too, but then when I started thinking about it, I realized, wait, no, it is possible. And here's how we do it. The Kickstarter's running, and it's running from now, I believe, until around mid-September, I think, is when it ends. And, I would love to have the community's support, or at least their help in, you know, making people aware of it.
So if you want to find out more about that, there's three places you can go. One is either go to its main website at tabletalesseries.com. There's also currently a sub-forum for it off the main Fear the Boot forums. And then last of all, there's, of course, the Kickstarter itself. I'll be sure to provide links to all three in the show notes if you want to see what Chris has got going on. Yeah.
Even if you're not going to back it, you have to go watch the video because that is a very dapper Chris.
Oh, thank you very much.
It is a dapper Chris, and I've also got to say that some of that is pretty damn funny, too. Chris, you did a great job on the intro video.
And you look very spiffy with your little beard and whatnot.
My little beard, like my little beard and my little hairstyle. Yeah,
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Chris is all groomed. He's got, you know, just enough makeup on for the camera. He's wearing a tux. I mean, hell, he's ready to bury.
I'm rehearsing for that, you know,
we're gonna launch you in a boat like the Lady of Shalott.
I think she just said she wants to light you on fire.
No, you put him in a boat.
That's
and
okay,
push him down to Camelot.
Maybe I just want to light him on fire.
Maybe you just want to light him on
I'm
fire.
On a boat.
Someone wants to light you on fire.
I'm on
Chris.
A boat. That's all right, come on baby, light my fire.
The boat is on fire.
The boat is on fire.
So anyway, thank you guys for tuning in. Have a great week and great games. And we will
see ya.
Catch you on fire.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2013. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.